My man. Here we are. What a deal, huh? Fellowship of the Spirit. Give it up. You betcha. My name's Juanita, and I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon Fellowships. I say fellowships because we got Alateen attached to us. Yeah. You know what, though? I'm going to tell you. You know, okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. I don't know. It just happens sometimes. Guess I should check the time here. Gary left, so he may be leaving me on my own. So if he does, we're in trouble. You know what I loved already about this meeting tonight? The laughter. At an Al-Anon meeting. Go figure. The laughter. When I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting, what was gone was the laughter. It wasn't there. Nothing was funny. You know? Nothing was funny. So we got to be here and hear Sarah talk about this brain tumor and laugh. Now here's the kicker. For this evening, the fun's over. Okay? Now we're going to get down and dirty. I was talking to Tom, and I said, Tom, I am so nervous. And he said, Juana, he said, you know, these people just love you. He says, you could get up there and cry for an hour, and it'd be fine. And I told Marie called me and left me a message, and she says, I know you're really nervous. She said, but, you know, you could read the phone book for an hour, and we'd all still love you. So I thought I'd take care of both of those at the same time. Just kidding. You know, I have absolutely no clue what's going to come out of these lips. It's going to be as much a surprise as it is to me. But I did have this little gem at home. And this is an old, old piece of Al-Anon conference-approved literature. It's actually got the little conference-approved logo. And it is entitled, To the Wives and the Family Afterward. And I just, you know, just couldn't resist. And it says as an introductory note, the two articles in this pamphlet constitute chapters 8 and 9 of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, basic text of the informal fellowship of recovered alcoholics. Can you imagine that? An Al-Anon piece of literature, which now has an estimated 300,000 members in more than 80 countries. Today, these chapters dealing with family problems are still of special significance to relatives of alcoholics. They indicate that from its earliest days, AA has been keenly aware of the profound disturbances that alcoholism can cause in a family. They show that AA has always recognized that newfound sobriety may in itself create a need for unusual tolerance, understanding, and delicate adjustments in family living. These chapters, reprinted here with AA's permission, this is in the 1950s, are reproduced practically verbatim. But since they were taken out of their context, a few minor adaptations were necessary. Well, excuse me, I'm going to flip over to the next page, and it says, give me a second. Well, anyway, it's here if you want it, because I just lost it. Who had the brain tumor? You know, I just get a hang of something and I just can't let it go. Okay. Okay. Hey, I said my prayers. You know, whatever happens, it's God's business. Okay, here we go. We hope these two chapters will tempt the reader to peruse the entire AA book. For it is most desirable for the mate of an alcoholic to have as much understanding of the problem as possible. And then it tells where we can purchase Alcoholics Anonymous textbook. What a deal, huh? What a deal. And then I'm going to read you from Family Afterwards something really quick, because it is one of my absolute favorite things in this book. All members of the family should meet upon the common ground of tolerance, understanding, and love. This involves the process of deflation. The alcoholic, his wife, his children, his in-laws, each one is likely to have fixed ideas about the family's attitudes towards himself or herself. Each is interested in having his or her wishes respected. We find the more one member of the family demands that the others concede to him, the more resentful they become. This makes for discord and unhappiness. And why? Is it not because each wants to play the lead? Is not each trying to arrange the family show to his liking? Is he not unconsciously trying to see what he can take from family life rather than give? That was me. That was me. My whole life. You know, I was looking for what I could get and not what I could give. I had nothing to give. By the time I showed up here, I needed you all so bad. And I was clueless. Absolutely clueless. Years ago, I saw this movie about Patsy Cline. It's called Sweet Dreams. And in this one part of the movie, she's sitting in the back of the car with the guy she just met who's going to be her husband, which, anyway. And at one point, she says, after some time with him, she says, you know, I was starving to death and I didn't even know it. And that was me. I was starving to death for something and I didn't even know it. I didn't even know it. And I got to you, I got to the meetings of Al-Anon. You know, that's a lie. I said a prayer, said, God, let me tell the truth. So the truth is, my very first meeting was not a meeting of Al-Anon, it was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked in, they hugged me, and I was scared to death that they would think that I was an alcoholic. And they should have thought that, because I wasn't looking too good. And I said, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. And they said, that's okay, honey. They gave me a little what they called a desire chip. And I said, take this home with you. We're just glad you're here. And I sat in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was scared to death. Because I could relate to the alcoholics who were sharing their stories that morning. It was a Sunday morning in Albuquerque, and I could relate to the pain that they were referring to. And I was so scared, because I was just telling them that I wasn't one, and I was scared that maybe I was, because I got it. You know? I got it. And I left there scared, and I still hadn't gone to a meeting of Al-Anon. Tom was at a treatment center. And when I took him into the treatment center, they said, we're going to keep him for about 30 days. I thought, right on. Woo! And they said, and before we let him out of here, you have to go to at least 3 Al-Anon meetings before we let him out. And I thought, you want him that bad, you can have him. But you know, I wanted to do the deal right. I wanted, if I wasn't going to be supportive, because I wasn't sure I wanted to be supportive, I wanted to look supportive. You know? Had to play the part. I wanted him to think that I was the good wife. I was the okay one, and he was all the trouble. He was trouble, and, you know, everything that was wrong in my life was his fault. And that's where I was. I believed that everything that was wrong in my life was Tom's fault. So I walked into a meeting of Al-Anon several weeks later. Tom would call me up after he attended his first AA meeting there at the treatment center, and he said, "Man, I found these little group, this little group every morning they meet, and they're just terrific, and Juana, you ought to go to an Al-Anon meeting. Have you gone?" I'd say, "No." Because see, if he was telling me to go, or he was suggesting it, that was the last thing I wanted to do. And he says, "You really should go. I think you're going to love them. I love these people, you know, from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really think you're probably going to like the people who go to Al-Anon." And I didn't want to go. I didn't want to go. I can't even tell you why I didn't want to go, but I didn't want to go. I didn't want it to be my problem. I didn't want there to be anything wrong with me. But I finally went just to shut him up. And also because Family Day was coming up, and that was my second one, and you had to play the part, you know. And so I went in, and I sat down, and I looked at everyone coming in, and I saw a bunch of housewives, and I was not one. I saw a lot of aging hippies, and been there, done that. And saw a lot of people dressed very nicely in their professional clothes, suits and such, and I knew they couldn't help me either. You see, I worked in an office. I was a professional woman. People where I worked weren't talking about the things that were going on in my home. And I knew that those people couldn't help either. But I sat there because I want to report and I want to look good when I report in. And I listened to people share and I just thought, "You poor people." You know, they had such miserable, sad, pitiful lives. And they were talking about this God and, so bad, so terrible. You know, I just wanted to crawl under the table. I just felt so embarrassed for them talking about this stuff. And finally, it was almost the end of the meeting, and this one gal said, "You know, I just don't know what to do to get my husband sober. How do I get him into the treatment center?" And she went on for a little bit, and then she said, "Thank you very much." And my arms shot up. I'd been to one Family Day, you know. And I started to tell them all how to get their spouses into the treatment center. I didn't. And when I finished, I said, "Thank you very much." And they all said, "Thank you for sharing. Keep coming back." And I thought, you know, I thought those little magic words, they need me. True. They need me. And I thought, "I'll come back." You obviously... This is weird, isn't it? Anyway... Ay-yi-yi. Anytime. I'm coming back because I still think you need me. And you know what the truth of it is? I need every one of you so much more. Be lost without every single one of you. Tom and I started coming to this conference in 93.
And we started to hook up with some incredible people with such wonderful recovery. And where we lived, it was just me at my Al-Anon meetings. My sponsor wasn't coming to meetings anymore. Her sponsees were coming sporadically. There was not much stuff going on with steps, with recovery, with the big book. And I came here, and I did not expect to like it. I did not expect to like this conference at all. Very few Al-Anons here that first year. And I can't tell you that I felt a part of. Because I was still looking in certain ways how I was not like you. I had heard a dear friend of mine, Arbutus, speak. And Arbutus, when I first heard her share, said, "We have one program and two fellowships." Our fifth tradition in Al-Anon says we practice the 12 steps of AA ourselves. Doesn't say we practice the 12 steps of Al-Anon. It says we practice the 12 steps of AA ourselves. Al-Anon has no steps. Sorry. Hate to break it to you. They're not Al-Anon steps. They are the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill Wilson begged Lois to take them and start some meetings for the families. She didn't want to do it. Shoot, I didn't want to do it. Been responsible our whole lives. Give me a break, right? Don't want to do it. Only I didn't know how to be responsible for the things I needed to be responsible for. See, I was busy taking care and being responsible for everyone else. And my own stuff was falling by the wayside. I wasn't being responsible for me. I wasn't being a grown-up. By the time I got to you, I wasn't a mother. My mother raised my first daughter. She turns 33 years old tomorrow. Can you imagine? I'll help you with the math. I'm 50. I was 17 when I had her. I got to Al-Anon, my very first meeting, July 2nd, 1982. I've been in 18 years. When I walked in at the age of 32, I thought, man, they're old. We have people in their teens and in their 20s, and it's amazing to watch. This conference that I did not want to be a part of, that I really didn't want to come up to, proved to be a safe haven for me. It became a place where I could recharge my batteries. You see, back home, I had one sponsee, maybe two. And I was an old timer with 6 years. Scary, isn't it? I could come here and I could be a baby. I could just be a baby. I could listen to giants. People I respected and loved, came to love. Talk about these steps, talk about their experience. And I felt like a child held in someone's arms. And then I could go home and show up and be responsible to my meetings. Because I didn't want to do it. I felt like a lone voice back home. Yeah, bring out the fiddles. But it was true. And I share this because I come here and today there are people who come to this conference and they say the same things. I'm alone. Where I'm at, there's nobody doing this stuff. come on back. We'll rock you in our arms, man. And we'll be solid for you. And we'll give you what you need so that you can go back home and be responsible to your groups and be responsible to your sponsees. And then bring him on back next year. Bring him back next year. There's a part of me that is sad that we've sold out already, that we're full, because I miss some of the old faces. But it also tells me that we're doing something very, very right, because we should be getting new people in. Tells me we're carrying a message and that people are starving for this stuff. My buddy Joe, he used to say, people are starving for this. You keep doing it. And here we are, and they are. So this conference fills me. Tom and I, on the way up here, were talking about all the various Al-Anon speakers that had come. And we were rattling them off. We were talking about them all. And I was saying, you know, every single one meant something so special to me. And every one of them was so special. I mean, everybody has what every one of those Al-Anon speakers has done is shown members of Alcoholics Anonymous that we're not so different. We're not so different. Our 12 steps are the same. You only have one word that's different. Alcoholics carry the message to alcoholics. Al-Anons carry it to others. Everything's the same. The only thing that's different is how we use alcohol in the first half of the first step. That's about it. Talk to members of AA. They don't even know I'm an Al-Anon. And when they find out, they go, my God, you're just like me. Boy, I was scary to hear it the first time. But it's true. My friend Rusty Kelly. First conference she didn't make it to. We missed her, but her spirit was here. I still feel her spirit. Every single person who has come here to this conference has left something behind. I don't care who they are, and I don't care what fellowship they belong to. Everyone has left a little bit of their spirit for our fellowships to appreciate and to hang on to. When Marilyn called me and asked me if I would come and share my story, oh man, I wanted to go, no. I can't do it. But I was taught to say yes. And my sponsor, Mary Thayer, who spoke here the second year of this conference, got from Rusty Kelly these words, "The phone won't ring if God doesn't want you." Phone won't ring if God doesn't want you. So show up and you say yes. Thank you. Because the truth be known, I've always wanted to do this. It's true. Scared to death to do it, but wanted to do it. Never thought I'd do it. So thank you, Marilyn. Okay, I love this conference. I'm just a screwed up Al-Anon. I'm just a family member that needs Al-Anon so bad. I'm going to tell you a little story, okay? I'm going to tell you a little story about how family disease of alcoholism progresses, how it progressed for me. Tom and I got together. Now, my dad drank when I was little. My dad drank till shortly after Tom got sober. His drinking affected me. I watched it affect my mom. I watched it affect my brother, who was 5 years younger than me. By the time I met Tom, I had a daughter. I'd been married. I'd been divorced. Mom raised that first kid. Met him. Immediately
We were there.
And we'd moved in within a month and a half. About 4 months into our living together, I walked into the bathroom, and he was in the tub. He worked hard. He was a construction worker. He worked outside. I think it was wintertime about this time, and he'd fallen asleep in the tub. I thought, oh, poor guy. He worked so hard. I let out some of the water, filled it back up, not too high, not, it was cold, filled it up with some hot water, not too hot, not too cold, not just right. And I went to bed, and sometime he came to bed in the middle of the night. And, you know, I just felt sorry for the guy because he was a hard worker. And a couple of months went by, and, you know, we had a couple of things start to happen. We ended up married about 11 months after that, and we had a little daughter. He brought two boys into our marriage. I brought a little girl. The boys were 7 and 5. My daughter was 6. And then we had another one. We wanted to spread the deal. We had such a loving family. And, you know, I was at the hospital having my daughter. He'd come and visit me, stay 10 minutes, and he'd have to leave. And he'd come by every day, stay for 10 minutes and leave. After being there four days, the doctor finally came in and said to me, "Honey, you can't stay here any longer. You got to go home. You've only just had a baby." You know, I didn't want to go. I felt safe for the first time in a long time. I felt taken care of. I felt like I just didn't have to be responsible, and I didn't want to go. But I had to. And I went home. He came and picked me up after telling me he'd be right there. I waited about 2.5 hours and, you know, got home, and the house was a wreck. And I had left it spotless. You know, I had those nesting instincts, and I wanted a nice, clean home to bring my little baby to, and it wasn't like that. And we had violence come into our home, and one night he beat me in a blackout, and they took him to jail. My oldest daughter, who was then 8, had to call the police and ask them to come get their stepdad to, you know, quit beating their mom, her mom. The baby, who was 6 months old, was sleeping in the living room because that's where her crib was. And our daughter, my 8-year-old daughter, his boys, when they came over, were sleeping in the bedroom, in the living room, because the extra bedroom that we had was full of trash. And our entertainment center that our TV sat on was an old Mexican chair with the straw falling out of it. That was home. And they took him to jail that night, and he came home the next day, and I was home. I came home from work at noon, and he said, "Juana," he said, "I love you so much." He said, "I can't believe," he said, "I was in the police car. All of a sudden, I came to," he said, "and they told me what I'd done, and I said, I wouldn't beat my wife." And they said, "Buddy, you beat your wife. Your daughter had to call us." And he said to me that day at noon, he said, "If drinking turns me into that kind of animal, that I will do that to you, the woman who I love." He said, "I'll never drink again." And I knew he meant it. I knew he meant it. And that night he was drunk. I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure it out. And I couldn't figure it out because, you see, I drank a lot. I mean, a lot. A lot. I drank so much that I'd go into blackouts and I wouldn't know how I'd get home. So if I drank that much and I could cut down my drinking, I couldn't understand why he couldn't. I just didn't get it. See, I had no idea about alcoholism. I didn't know about the disease of alcoholism. I thought if I could change the way I drank, so could he. A couple of years later, I walk into the bathroom. This time I know he's not asleep. This time I know he's passed out. And if I could have gotten the local ice plant to come and dump its load of ice in the tub, I'd have done it. Because my mission in life had become to make him miserable. I was miserable, and I was in so much pain that I wanted to make him miserable. Clueless, completely clueless, that this man was suffering as much or perhaps more than I was. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. And I didn't care. I didn't care. I didn't care about him. I would tell you I loved him. I wanted to love him, but I wasn't sure anymore if I even cared. You know, next few years, something happened that I started to pray to a God that I believed was a punishing God, a God that I didn't think much of, to take his life. He'd have to travel from Santa Fe to Pewaukee, 16 miles to get to our home, and I knew he'd be drunk, maybe in a blackout, and I would say, tonight's the night he's not going to make it. Tonight's the night where he's going to go off the cliff where I had lost an uncle in a drunken car wreck several years before. And every night he'd make it. Every night he'd show up. God didn't work. It got to the point that one couple of nights, Tom made it home, but he couldn't make it in the house. Middle of winter, 3-4 inches of snow on the ground, and he passes out there, and I leave him. Turn out the light, shut the door, and I think, that's it. Tomorrow morning, I'll be the widow. He made it in. Worse. He'd come in freezing cold and snuggle up, you know? Add insult to injury, you know? And then came the day when I walked in the bathroom one evening about 9 or so, and I saw him passed out in the tub. And I thought, who would know if I were to shove him under? He's an alcoholic. He's a drunk. You know? And I watched my hand stretch out to put his head under the water. And I had two thoughts. And I really, truly believe that these were God-given thoughts at this point. My first thought was, remember that little TV show, Columbo? Talk to him, you know. I thought there's going to be this cop in Santa Fe, and he's gonna know. Columbo always got his man or his woman, and Columbo came to mind, and the next thought was, and what's going to happen to your children? Their father's dead, their mother's in prison, and what happens to the kids? And I just left the bathroom. And I don't believe I ever again went into the bathroom at night when I thought he might be passed out in there. The family disease of alcoholism was progressive for me. I've watched it progress in recovery. 5 years into this program, working with a sponsor, going to meetings, sponsoring people. My first sponsor left me. She said, go do your deal. You're too dependent on me. I can't work with you anymore. So I was between sponsors for a good long time, and I quit working the steps. Guess what steps I was at?
Nine.
Tom and I were taking a little trip up to, I don't know how to tell this whole long story. We had a family of mice that my daughter had become attached to. A lot of mice. It started out with only two. Before we knew it, it was like 30. And they have a tendency to become cannibalistic when there's too many of them. And my daughter witnessed an act of cannibalism one day and freaked out and came running. And I said, they're out of here, man. And she says, yeah, Mom, they're out. I don't want them. And so we're on our way to Hyde Park, the mountains, and to get rid of these mice. And we come into Santa Fe, and there's this little pet store as you come in. And Tom said, let's stop in here, and just to stop in, you know, you can't put anything past this little brain. And I'm thinking, oh, great, he's going to want to keep these damn mice. And we spent, I'd say, over 2 hours in the pet store, and Tom kept saying, oh, she's been so responsible with these mice, and maybe a bigger cage, maybe two cages. We live in a two-bedroom mobile home. Hello. And finally I said, let's go. We're going to get rid of those mice, and off we go up the mountain. And, you know, she's in the back seat. She's about 12, and Tom's driving, and I'm in the passenger seat. And he said, oh, maybe we're just being a little too quick on this. Maybe we're a little hasty. You know, he started the spiel again, and I lost it. I lost it. I started screaming at the top of my lungs, you never listen to me, you never listen to me. And I grabbed the steering wheel and I yanked with all my might. And the car swerved, he almost lost control. My daughter's in the back seat yelling, Mom, what's wrong with you? What's going on? Screaming and crying. And he's going, what's wrong with you? What's going on? And all of a sudden I sit there and I go, I don't know. I almost killed my family. And I realized how the family disease of alcoholism is every bit as progressive for me as it is for the alcoholic. You see, I wasn't working steps. I wasn't taking my medicine. I wasn't doing the deal. And what I found out is that I'm either moving closer to God and staying sane, or I'm moving further away from Him. Can't do both. And I had quit doing the things that moved me closer to God. Went back to the steps. Had my, got a new sponsor. Had her for about a week. Came home from a conference here in Colorado, woman to woman. And a couple of days after that conference, I came home one day, came home this day, and my daughter's friend's mother came to the door, and she said, don't panic. People weren't coming to my house still, believe me. You know, she said, but don't panic. She said, I had to take your daughter to the emergency room, and she said, she's okay. But she tried to kill herself. This was our baby, who was 7 years old when we came into the program. We thought if anything like this happened, it would be to our older kids. Not our baby. Not the one who was seven. I walked into the emergency room and I said, Mijita, I said, did it hurt so bad in here that you had to do that? And she started crying and she says, yeah, Mama, it did. Yeah, Mama, it did. So we put her into the adolescent psychiatric unit for a couple of weeks. And one day we were sitting there with a counselor and her. And the counselor asked her a question. The counselor said, do you believe your mom and dad love you? You know, she had to think a minute. 5 years. 5 years we're in this. And she had to think a minute. And then she said, yeah, now I do. Now I do. You see, Tom and I had learned how to become husband and wife. He'd learned how to become a sober man. I learned how to become a woman in recovery. We'd become partners. We'd become friends. We had become lovers. We still didn't know how to be parents. We were at home in a desert of recovery. We had to learn how to be parents. Mary Thayer got a hold of us. And one of the things she said when she sat down and spoke to us was, she said, suicide weaves a web of guilt amongst everyone who loves the person who has suicided or attempted suicide. And she said, you two are going to find yourselves having fights. And Tom said, oh, no, we're in this together. We're in this for our daughter. We're in this. And she says, she said, listen, you are going to have fights. And she said, when you do, she said, I want you to turn to page 118 of the big book, the chapter to the wives. And it says in there, and this is what I want you to pay attention to. It is the privilege of either to say, this is getting heated. I think we should discuss this later. We didn't think it was going to happen. 2 days later, man, we're in the kitchen and we're just like going at it. And we both kind of go, it's getting a little hot. It's getting heated. And we just cracked up laughing, you know, because we just saw ourselves. Our lives are an example of taking mistakes and saying, okay, God, we screwed up. Now what? Show me what's the next thing to do. Our lives are an example of two people showing up and saying, I was wrong. My first sponsor, when I was first going through the steps, said to me, because I had a little problem with jealousy, and she kept me on it for a while, and finally she said, I can't do a thing with you. She said, I want you to go to the psychiatrist and talk to him and let him take care of you. And so I went and saw him and had a few visits with him, and I was telling him the deal. And he said to me, you know what your problem is? He says, you can't decide if you're going to stay or if you're going to go. I thought, man, that's brilliant. And he said, here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to go home and I want you to be as kind and as loving, as considerate as you can possibly be towards him. I left his office furious. Absolutely furious. I got home, didn't even put down my purse, and I was on the phone to my sponsor, and I said, do you know what that SOB said? And she says, uh-huh. And I said, well, what do you think about that? And she said, I think you're paying him $125 an hour. Why don't you try doing what he says? I couldn't hear it until I'd paid for it. My sponsor had been telling me that for years. I couldn't hear it until I'd paid for it. Started this thing I called hit and run. I'd go up to Tom, he'd be sitting at the kitchen table, and I'd give him this peck on the cheek, and I'd leave. Wouldn't look. Don't look at the response, don't look at the reaction, just kiss and leave. Go give him a hug, don't look, just head on out, you know? Did this for a while, because I was scared he was going to go like, forget it, chick, you know? Don't want that from you. So a couple of weeks later, you know, I'm going by the kitchen. He's sitting at the kitchen table, and he said something. I don't even know what the question was. And he says, don't you think, honey? Don't you think, dear? Something. I don't know what it was. And I stopped dead in my tracks. And I thought, oh, my God. I can't believe that. Listen to that word coming out of his mouth. But you know what the real miracle of it was? That I had started to do it because I wanted to. I started to do it because I felt it in here. I felt love for him. I felt care for him. I felt consideration for him. I didn't even need to get anything back. That was the beauty of it. My blessing was I didn't need to have it. I had it without needing to get anything from him. Well, I have a home group. My home group is the New Hope Al-Anon group. We meet every Wednesday at 12:10 in Santa Fe. If you ever come by, come join us. And if you haven't guessed it, I'm going to tell you, I have a home conference. It's this one. We meet every year in the mountains of Colorado in July. I'm accountable to my home group, and I'm accountable to this conference. So I know Tom got together with a couple of you folks last night and had a meeting. And he told you a little bit of what our year had been like. His mom died this January. And I will tell you that I got there just in time. I wasn't going to go. Tom kept telling me, you don't need to come. We're okay here. And I called my sponsor and I told her what was going on with me. And she said, honey, you need to go for you. And I did. And I walked in. I got there late that night on a Thursday at 9 o'clock. And I said to my mother-in-law, I said, how you doing, Ann? And she said, not good. And what she'd been saying to everyone else up to that point was, okay, fine. And she said to me, not good. And I knew it wasn't good. And the next day, the afternoon, we lost her. And I want to tell you, go back a little bit. My brother died a year into this program. I was a year into these rooms when my brother died. And when he died, I said goodbye to him. I started my amends, did some amends with him. But what happened was my whole family just left the room after he'd passed away. And I really felt deep within me a need to sit there with him. I can't tell you why. I just felt this unbelievable need just to sit there with him. I know it was just his body, but I just felt this need. And so when Tom and I were at the hospital Friday morning before my mother-in-law passed away, I said to him, I was telling him this story. I told him about how I really wished I had stayed with my brother, you know, but I didn't because the whole family was going and I just felt like I should go. And I said, and I really felt like I should have stayed there and just prayed and just been there, like just present to as the spirit left. And when his mother died, we stayed there with her for a while. We got to hold hands, and I got to witness him doing something that I thought, that I believe, is probably the most caring act I've ever seen him do. I watched him get a washcloth, put it in warm water, and wash his mom's face and her hands and her feet. And I just Oh, I just saw the tenderness and the love of him doing that. You see, something had shifted in our relationship somewhere along the way. And God gave me the ability to be vulnerable, not just to my sponsor, not just to my sponsees, but to the man whom I share my life with. And I couldn't have done that without the steps, and I couldn't have done that without God, because I never wanted to be vulnerable before him. I had to be tough. I had to be hard. Because you see, if I'm vulnerable, if I let the love in, I got to let the pain in too. And I don't want to feel the pain. So I put this wall up and I build it really thick and I build it really high to keep the pain out. But what you all taught me was that if I don't break the wall down and let the pain in, I don't let the joy in either. So because I learned how to be vulnerable because of you, and because of God gave me the power and his love, and he lets me be vulnerable with him, I was able to share this and I was able to witness this. And what a gift. What a gift.
Well, that was just the beginning of the year, and we came up here to the Fellowship of the Spirit board meeting and had an accident and almost didn't make it. Showed up at Mickey Marie's door and banged up, man. And missed the board meeting and went on to Estes Park and listened to Don and Janice D. share their experience that weekend. Had a great weekend. So I'm going to tell you a little story that I'm not proud of, but I got to tell it. Tom said I had to tell it. And I'm going to tell it just because I know he shared with some of you guys, so I'm going to tell my side of it. Because I don't know what he told you, but I had just come back from North Dakota. I'd spoken there that weekend in May. It was the second to last weekend in May, and I'd come back and done a great job, hung out with some great people that week, that weekend, and this was Sunday I came back. Monday, I'm meeting with a sponsee at noon, and long story short, okay. Going back home after meeting with my sponsee, I'm in a hurry. I have a little problem with speeding, okay? Little problem with speeding. I just can't quite not speed. That's a defect that God hasn't taken care of. It's like my foot gets on the pedal and it's pedal to the metal, baby. Come on, let's go. And all of a sudden, I hear these sirens, and I'm, dang, you know, again. And I pull over, and because I'm law-abiding, right? And this cop comes to my window, and he has to give him all the necessary stuff he needs, and he goes back to his car, and it's taken a long time. I mean, I've gotten speeding tickets before, and 10 minutes tops, and then I'm out of here, right? Well, Tom gives me a call, and I tell him, I'm stopped, and, you know, we had some things that he wanted me to take care of at home with the business, and so, you know, he was, and I said, and you know what's really weird? This is after 20 minutes. I said, there's like two cops here now, two cop cars and two cops. I said, and there had been three, but he's just leaving now. And he goes, well, Juana, do you want me to come up? And I'm like, oh, no, 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 no. Because I know if he comes up, it's going to get ugly. Because he's going to come and rescue me, you know? Bad idea. And so I'm there, and, you know, I've got my book with me, and it's taking a while, so I pick up my book, and I'm reading, and finally, about, you know, another half hour goes by, and I got out of the car, walked over to policeman, and he's going, back in the car, ma'am. And I'm like, what's the problem? Back in the car. I said, okay. So I got back in the car. And I guess I got to tell you a little story. When Tom and I, jeez, I never should have gotten into this. When we were first together, one of our very first New Year's, we'd gotten a little loaded, and I got mad at him. Walked over to this bar, had like five planters punches, and finally walked home. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm driving back to pick him up because he's passed out at a friend's house, and hey, I'm ready for the night, you know? Let's get it on. And all of a sudden, I turn this curb, and apparently I went over several curbs, and I've got five flat tires, and I'm sorry, two flat tires, and I ended up, felt like five, and I hit a Mercedes-Benz, all in front of a cop. And I'm not going anywhere, and he drives up behind me, and he has me walk the line, and I fail. And he cuffs me, and he puts me in the back of his police car, and we take off. And I said, where are we going? And he says, I'm taking you to jail. And I said, wait a minute, there's no windows, there's no handle. And he goes, no, honey, there's not. And I said, well, why are you taking me to jail? And he said, drunk driving. I said, I'm not drunk, I'm tripping. Anyway, I used my mother's name to get me out of it. He took me home. So I got out of jail that time. And so the cop comes and knocks on my car window. And he says, step out, ma'am. And I get out of my car, and I'm thinking, this is a new one. This has never happened before. Why would he want me to come out? Something doesn't sound right. And he says, here's your citation for speeding. He says, do you want to pay it or you want to go to court? And I said, I did it. I'll pay it. And he said, and here's one more thing. He says, we have a bench warrant out for your arrest. I said, no way. No way. He goes, yeah, we have a bench warrant. He says, I've got to take you in. I said, no. And I'm like, my brain is going. And I take a look at these two cops, and my first thought is, there's only two of them. I can take them. It's true. And my next thought is, okay, might be a bad idea. Pause when agitated or doubtful, and I was a little doubtful at that moment. And I thought, you know what? I was pissed. You see, I don't accept stuff like this nicely. My first instinct is to fight you. And what I got was, you just say please and thank you, and yes, officer, no, officer, and you do whatever he tells you. And he says, turn around, ma'am, I'm going to cuff you. And so I said, yes, sir, and I did, and he took me. And, boy, he shows me a copy of my bench warrant about an hour later, and I put it aside, and finally I pick it up, and I look at it, and I think, that's not my name. It's not my name. Pulled out my driver's license that I'd stuck in my back pocket and looked at my driver's license number, looked at the address, wasn't the same. And I called him quickly, and I could just hear him on the other side, because I said, this isn't me, and I could just hear him going, like they hadn't heard that one before, right? And anyway, they had to take me to the county detention center in Santa Fe, because this was the tribal police that stopped me. And he says, I'm taking you into the county detention center. And I thought, oh, not the county detention center, of all places. I'd been taking an Al-Anon meeting in there. When I first started going in there, I told him my story. The gals loved me. They said, I got your back, you know. And I just knew when they took me in there that they were going to go, you finally killed the SOB, huh? Knew we'd see you here. So Tom finally got me out, paid my bond, and got me out, and I made some calls to the courts and stuff, and long story short, it should never have happened. I had a suspended license back in October. I got a speeding ticket, and I went into motor vehicle to pay it. They took the money. They should have said, we can't take your money. You go see the judge on a suspended license, but they took it. And when I made calls after that, everybody said I was clean. So I made some more calls, and they said, you don't need to come in. But you know what I got? I'm an old bureaucrat.
My first mistake way back in September, was to not say, show me the paperwork. Who set the ball rolling? I did. First of all, I broke the law. I was speeding. Second of all, I know I should take a look at the paperwork. I should make sure that everything is in order, and I didn't. And so when I called this last time, now in May, and they said, you don't need to come in, I thought, maybe I better get in there and take a look at the paperwork. So I got in, and they found me, and they said, you need to see the judge. And not on this one, but on the past one. And I said, okay, went in and saw him. And I had all my paperwork with me, so I showed it all to him. And he said, boy, this never should have happened. And I started to apologize to him. I said, you know, Your Honor, I said, I never meant to be disrespectful of the court. I never meant to be disrespectful of the laws of the state of New Mexico. And I'm really sorry. And I kept on for a bit, and you're not getting the whole story, but you don't need to. And he said, I'm the one who has to apologize to you. He said, it never should have happened. And there's some people who thought I should have sued, but you know what? It was one I owed him from way back when. It was one I owed him. My time is up. I didn't even get to amends. And I so wanted to tell you. I got so much to tell you. Damn it. I got relationships in my life with my family that they're killer. They're great. My mom is getting old, so is my dad. You know, my dad comes over and complains about my mom, you know, how she doesn't remember stuff and he's really worried. And then dad comes, and then, you know, my mom comes and complains about him, and they're both getting old. And my mom loves to bowl, and we go bowling. I hate bowling, but I go bowling, you know. And my dad is just so cute, and he just comes every Saturday and empties our trash. He takes our trash to the dump because he just wants to be helpful. You know, I didn't know how to be helpful. I had to come here and work steps to learn how to be helpful. Daddy just does it. Tom and I have 7 grandkids. They think we're the best. They love Grandma. They absolutely love Grandma. I'll get a little message from him and go, Grandma, call me. Call me, Grandma. And then they'll go, it's a message, Mom. You know, and since I'm out of time, I guess I just want to tell you, you all have been my support. The steps gave me a God that has solved all my problems. I have yet to come across a problem that I am not able to turn over to God and have God take care of. If I got nothing out of this program but the love I have for the God of my understanding, I don't need any money. But beyond the God of my understanding that the program gave me, I got the ability to open up this heart that when I got here was 3 sizes too small, just like the Grinch's. And it is so full. Because I get to go to a well that is limitless. And the well is the God of my understanding. And the love that I can access there never ends. There is no limit. And because of that, the more love I give, the more I'm able to give. And the more I get, What a deal. I love you guys so much. I don't even have the words. I didn't tell you nothing of what I wanted to tell you. And if you get nothing from this talk, except that I love you, and that I truly, truly, with every fiber of my being, love you. Bye.